Hey, and thank you for tuning in to the Learn to Code with Me podcast. In this episode, you'll find out the history of the internet and what it means to be digitally literate. That's all coming up after a quick word from our sponsors. Do you want to automate your workflow to save hours of manual data entry? MailParser takes email data and uses parsing filters to help you understand your customers. Get a free trial and 30% off your first year over at mailparser.io/learn-to-code-with-me. Product design is a lucrative and in-demand skill. With online programs, flexible classes, and one-on-one mentoring, Thinkful's product design program can help you land a job as a product designer. And guess what? You can try the course for free. Learn more over at learntocodewith.me/thinkful. Hello, listeners. In today's episode, I'm talking with Chris Castiglione. Chris is the co-founder and CEO of 1Month, and he teaches at Columbia University Business School. Chris's mission is to use storytelling and education as a tool to inspire positive change in the world. I already spoke with Chris in season 4, where we discussed Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, but this time we're talking about something totally different. Today, Chris tells us about a brief history of the internet and what it means for the internet to be decentralized. He also talks about the importance of having digital skills no matter what field that you're in and which skills are the most important to learn in 2019. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hey, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's great to have you back on.
Hey, Laurence, how's it going?
It's going well. How's it going with you?
Things are great. Yeah, I love the podcast, so I'm happy to be chatting with you today.
Yes, and last time we talked about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, and today our conversation is going to be, still tech-related, but pretty different. And we're going to be talking about digital literacy, which I'm really excited about. But I want to backtrack a bit and start by talking about how you got interested in tech. And we were doing research before the interview, and we saw that you started out in media, arts, and design. And we read that you were a music industry major, and that's when you first came across Napster, and that just kind of changed everything for you. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so I was never really into computers. I just always thought computers were for nerds and like the CS department, computer science department. I was a music major, and what happened, though, around the time that I was in college, so a little bit ago, but it was around 2000, 2001, was that this app came out, Napster. And for the first time in like the history of the world, you could all of a sudden have access to like any song you wanted at any moment. You didn't have to like wait for it to come on TV or on the radio or buy it. And it was like absolutely free. And so I was studying music in the music industry. Like I was even had one of my first jobs was as an intern at a recording studio in New York City called Stratosphere Sound, which I think is still here. And at the time I saw this Napster thing come out. And to me, it wasn't about music at all, though. It was about the power of coding, because it was like some kid like Sean Fanning, who we'd find out, basically made this app that was rivaling the music industry. He was basically, it was like making this revolution from his bedroom, basically. And I was just like, what is that? And so I was so interested that I left my major as in music. And that was my sophomore year. And then I switched to something called New Media. And it was the first year that they had ever done it. And it was basically a bunch of art and computer nerds trying to figure out what the internet was. And I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you then switched into the media arts and design. And that's what you ended up graduating.
I did. Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. And switching gears a little bit, but recently you've been writing a lot about the history of the internet and decentralization. Can you explain like first what that means and then how these two things are connected?
Yeah, totally. So the idea, and I'll say like the reason why I started writing about this is that the whole blockchain, Bitcoin, a lot of these ideas this idea about this, the new internet, this kind of new evolution of where the internet's going. I saw a lot of this happening, and it was as if it was happening in isolation, as if these were all new events. This is around, especially around 2017, 2018, when a lot of new people started getting involved. And the truth, though, is that none of these events are happening in isolation. Like, Bitcoin is not a new technology, really, or blockchain is not a new technology. They're really all part of a longer story that I'm calling it a brief history of the internet, because these ideas and technologies go back all the way to the 1960s, when a guy named Paul Barron was writing about decentralization and what he saw as the future of communications. So that got me really excited to share these stories and trying to give context, I would say, to like where we came from, because for a lot of people who bought into Bitcoin early, it wasn't just because they were like, you know, it wasn't random chance. I don't think it wasn't just because they were nerds or like had some investment lead. None of that was really part of the conversation. It was because they saw that vision and they were able to see where the future was going. And I believe it's true about the next 10 to 20 years. If you can see kind of the longer step back, longer tides of where we've come, that there's these like tectonic shifts kind of that happened, and they happen in patterns. And a lot of them are around this idea of decentralization that we're starting to hear a lot more about. And so that's what I've been writing about and trying to do it in a fun way that isn't, that's approachable for the 99% of people who haven't heard that term before.
Yeah. I'm curious. So how do you define decentralization?
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a million different definitions. So I think the easiest way, cause it does get a little bit complex, but if you imagine this idea of anyone, I mean, if you think about the way the internet works right now, right? Anyone could connect to anyone, sometimes we call it peer-to-peer, without a middleman. And so the idea is that with decentralization, you can have, let's say, 100 people connect to each other, and any one person can connect to anyone else in that group of 100. You know, I'm just making this 100 person thing up, but you have like a classroom of 100 people. Anyone can connect to anyone. You don't need permission from a middleman, right? And so it basically eliminates the middleman. Now, where have we seen that before? Well, before, let's say, Napster or a lot of what we consider the internet today, you had to go through a middleman. If you wanted to make a phone call, for example, you had to go through AT&T. You had to route through AT&T. You needed an operator, for example, right? Like literally, this is what my parents have told me, like in the 60s or something, you would call, you pick up your phone, and there's somebody like, literally be on the other side. You have to go through them to get where you're going. But now we don't need that. We can go person to person. And there's a lot written, and there's a lot of tectonic shifts that have happened of removing the middleman. So it started, we can say, with Napster as one big example, but then to the way that news media has disappeared, real estate, a lot of industries have really just been kind of building on this variation and this theme, this idea of removing the middleman. And Bitcoin and blockchain are one of the kind of newest variations on that theme.
Yeah. When you're talking about that, I'm also just thinking about like ride sharing, Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, so like home sharing or apartment sharing.
Yeah.
And all these other things that, especially I think over the last like decade have, as you said, been removing the middleman, but it's definitely been happening sooner than that.
And then so like the interesting question is like, think about places where there still are middlemen, and then where middlemen or middlewomen, and where we can, and where the future might be going. And whenever anybody kind of posits one of these, it always seems like, oh, that's never going to go away. You know, whether it's like central banking, Bank of America, whether it's, and this is just my own conjecture, but like certain parts of the government, you know, that we look to, are there places where there's this kind of bureaucracy in the middle where these decisions can be brought to the level of code, where there's like code that can be written that can, we can trust more to execute and to connect a variety of different people, you know, or millions of people, without having to rely on one middle person that, you know, and historically we've seen could be corrupt or, different self-interest, bias, mistakes, that kind of thing.
Got it. So you know, and you're very interested in this area of decentralization. You also teach a course on digital literacy. Well, it's called Digital Literacy for Decision Makers, and you teach that at Columbia University. What exactly is digital literacy? How is it different from decentralized? I know, I feel like it's different, but are they also kind of related?
Yeah. So digital literacy is the name of the course that I teach. It's at Columbia Business School, and it's generally second year business school students. And the course is really popular. A lot of people, that you have to use this like bidding system. And so it's often, you know, sold out, and a lot of people will know they need to take it. And I only say all of that, only to say that people really feel this need to learn technology skills, and they're in the business school, right? So like, in a way, I'm trying to point out how weird that is, that like this course, which about 10, 20 years ago, I think, didn't exist, but business school students were learning finance, business school students were learning, you know, things about economics and all this kind of stuff. And now there's this course, you know, digital literacy that I teach, and everyone kind of knows they need to take it or feels like they need to take it. But then on day one, you know, I'll ask them like, why are you taking this? And a lot of people don't even know why. They just have this, I don't know whether it's like a feeling to need stay, relevant, you know, because it's like, you know, things are changing. How do you stay relevant? Or a feeling to kind of understand like this stuff as it exists right now. Because, you know, what we find in the first class of the course is that most people don't know the way technology works right now, which inhibits the ability to understand what's coming next. And so example with that would be, you know, I have them go on the board and draw, you know, how data flows from me to my mom when I send a cat image, you know, sending an image of a cat, like, where does that go? Who handles that? All the processes of that. I have them research it. They do a little project, but like simple things like that, that we don't know where our data is going, really limits our ability to understand the way things work right now. And then it's really hard to understand the innovations that people are writing in depth about whether it's, you know, Facebook leaking, you know, the Facebook leaks, the Cambridge Analytica, to these data breaches we see. It's like hard to really understand like how this stuff affects you, or also that it could be different, which is what a lot of people are arguing, that this isn't the only way to build the internet. There are different ways, and these have been talked about for decades. And so they're really getting re-talked about now on how to make this system better. And so we go through kind of the past, present, and future of digital technologies surrounding the internet, as well as a little bit of learning to code, which I think is important, and some readings and all this kind of stuff. So that's more or less what the course is for.
Yeah, that's really awesome. And it is really fascinating that these are people at the business school that are taking this course, and they understand like the need to become digital. Wait, is it correct to say digitally literate? Is that right?
Yeah, sure. That sounds great. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Am I saying that right? Okay. Yeah, digitally literate. Okay. So they understand the need to do that. And I am just so curious, like the students in your class, what are their end goals? Like, are these people that want to become like CFOs, CEOs, and they just know that, okay, to operate in today's business world, I need to have a grasp on these concepts because of how much it is shaping.
Yeah, for sure. So it's business school, right? And also I'll say that I didn't go to business school. But I do run a business, you know, so I think that's part of why I'm there. But only to say that, you know, it is business school. So it's a traditional business school student. A lot of them are looking to get into finance. Some of them want to start their own businesses. Yeah. Be CFOs, CEOs, all of these kind of things are definitely where they're coming from. You know, that hasn't changed in business school. Where the digital literacy part comes in is that these executive roles, for example, are often in the situation where they need to, whether it's hire people who are digitally competent, whether it's, you know, listen to reports coming from the CTO, you know, and kind of influence and make decisions about these, or a lot of products these days are digital products. I mean, there's, you know, it'd be hard to find any company right now that doesn't have, whether it's a digital presence or, you know, a website or like something, you know, where you kind of need like the basics. I can give you like one example of Stripe comes to mind, the payment processing company. And I know that they have a lot of sales people that work for them and have to sell their, here's how payment processes work. Here's how an API works. Here's how, you know, when you query the data, it's kind of like SQL. It's difficult for salespeople, for marketing people to sell the product, to educate people you know, that they, I mean, I'm sure that their company is more than like 1,000 people at this point. Where do you find people who are, you know, both savvy in skills like financing, marketing, business, but can also kind of speak that tongue? And so that's like, I'd say that's been the culmination or like that's been the, what's the word, summary of a lot of the work I've been doing. Because I used to teach a course called, well, I still teach it, called Programming for Non-Programmers. And that was what spun into digital literacy, because that was similarly a lot of finance people, executive people that were just looking to speak the talk the talk, but not necessarily like become a developer. So yeah, that's been something I've been working on for a while.
That's all really awesome. And by the way, when you were talking, I looked up Stripe's company size, and it is 1,500 people as of February. Yeah, so you're close. And this just reminds me of something I love to say, and I just believe so much, is that every company nowadays is a tech company. Like as you were saying earlier,
100%.
Every company is one way or another is relying on technology in some ways, whether it's like for shipping products internally, like warehouse management or something, or to run their website or to do payment processing and, you know, all these other things. So just going back to digital literacy, what are T-shaped skills? Is this something that you teach that has to do with being digitally literate?
Yeah. So the idea of T-shaped skills, this idea has been around for a little bit. And the idea is that somebody with T-shaped skills has, if you think of the way a letter T looks, the capital letter T, think about a capital letter T, you have this kind of like broad, like left to right kind of horizon on the top. And then this vertical, like very specific kind of, you know, down. And then T-shaped skills would be to have a broad range of skills. So in some ways to be a generalist, but to be really specifically good at one thing, right? And an example of that is, so at my company, 1 month, we were a small company, you know, we're around 10 people. And so for that, the people on our team need to wear a lot of hats, right? And so, for example, the young fellow that we hired, my friend Zach now, to head our video department, he came in with really specific video skills. Like he was one of the best, you know, that I've seen, you know, I'd say at least like in his age range. You know, he was fresh out of college and he was making videos, he was editing videos. He had a lot of the skills that we needed. And it turned out he had a lot of broad skills, the top part of the T, where he also knew a little bit of how to code, right? He was definitely not a programmer, but he knew a little bit. He knew how to manage people. He'd taken a lot of leadership classes and communication classes and these kind of things, you know? So I think having a broad range of skills, like knowing the variety of different hats that you may have to wear and how things work, while also having one specific thing. And I think that's what a lot of people miss, because there are people who are generalists and, you know, they get out. And I think the hard part of being a super, super generalist, which I am, I could really relate to that, or have been for a long time in my life, is that when you're trying to get hired, it's sometimes difficult because people hire for specific skills. But once you're on the team, it's the broad part where you can really kind of go up in your position, you know, work better with other teammates, that the broad part really complements that.
Sit tight, podcast listeners. We're taking a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. Small businesses spend a lot of time managing logistics and trying to understand their customers. MailParser is a leading email processing tool that makes these things a lot simpler. First, you'll forward emails to MailParser manually or with custom email filters. Then, MailParser uses custom parsing rules to automatically extract the important information you need from the email body or attachments. You can view the extracted data on your MailParser dashboard or use webhooks to automatically send the data to your other business applications. MailParser offers a suite of parsing filters that are highly flexible and that can render custom output from almost all structured data. Whether you are capturing leads, analyzing order information, or figuring out what new features your customers want, you can do it efficiently with MailParser. Get a free 14-day trial to see if you like it, then 30% off the first year of service at mailparser.io/learn-to-code-with-me. Thinkful is a coding program that gets its graduates careers in tech. With online programs, flexible classes, and 6 months of support from a career coach, it's the perfect place to start your new career. In 2019, LinkedIn named product design one of the most promising jobs in the United States. With a median base salary of just over $121,000, this is a lucrative and in-demand career. Thinkful's product design program is built to get you a job as a product designer or your tuition back. With one-on-one mentorship and a support team behind you, you'll work on impressive projects to build your portfolio and prove your design abilities to future employers. What's more, this course fits around your schedule, so you can get ready for your new job without having to quit your current one. 90% of course graduates are hired as full-time designers, but thanks to Thinkful's tuition reimbursement guarantee, if you don't get a job within 6 months of graduating, you'll get your money back. To try this product design course for free, go to learntocodewith.me/Thinkful. Yeah, I think that was a really good example. And I'm sure a lot of folks listening, I can relate also to feeling like you have a lot of different passions and a lot of different interests. And yet again, a lot of different skills. And it's hard sometimes to know like what to convey to an employer, or like what to focus in on to get that job. Because as you mentioned, really when you're getting any kind of tech job, whether it's video editing or audio editing or programming, they're looking at a few key skills, you know, that you have.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the people listening to your podcast, learning to code. It's so overwhelming. There's so many different languages and frameworks and all the stuff that you could be learning. And in some ways it's good to know it all, like a little bit, you know? And in another way, which is probably more, it would be my more specific advice for people getting started, just pick something and go with it. Because you can always change. And because at the same time, having one thing, you know, like we use Ruby at our company to build the website, but we hired somebody who hadn't used Ruby that much, but was really good at Python back in the day, just because he was really good at Python, you know, and he just had so many great skills. And those kind of people can learn on the job and all that. But again, like just knowing that this person had really strong skills in one part, that I think that helps you stand out in interviews for sure.
Yeah. And I love the advice of just getting started with something and going with it. And once you know one programming language, it's a lot easier to learn more. I'm not a language speaker. Like I'm not bilingual or trilingual, but I remember when I studied abroad in Shanghai, and there was one guy in my program who got there and started learning Mandarin really fast. Like he had his Mandarin abilities and just reading and writing as well were ahead people who have taken it for years. And everyone was like, what is this guy doing? How is he learning it so fast? He was practicing. Turns out he was already trilingual. So I forget exactly. I think he knew German, English, and maybe Spanish fluently or something, like totally fluent. And it was just so easy for him to start learning Mandarin because he already knew these other languages, even though they're really different. But I guess I don't know a lot about the brain, but I imagine it's like similar parts of the brain that are being triggered. And then it's just a lot easier to do it the next time.
100%. People say that a lot about languages. If you've learned one, you just kind of, you know, the patterns, you know the certain parts that you need to excel at, you know, your own weaknesses, you know, how you learn best, all that kind of stuff. I think it's true for programming 100% as well.
Yeah. And what you said, just knowing how to learn, or that is such an important trait to have like in any job, because no matter where you're working, you're always going to have to learn something new, whether it's a tech skill or not. And personally, at my, you know, last full-time job, I found the hardest thing to learn for myself and just other things that I observed was like communication skills. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever find that too. Like, I feel like there can be, for me, like my most challenging moments in that job had nothing to do with technical stuff. It had to do with like communication related.
Do you mean like
challenges?
Do you mean like you felt personally challenged or like the people around you challenged?
Both. I mean, like I maybe wasn't communicating what I was trying to get across in the best way. And whether that was, usually it would be like verbally. I feel like through writing, I've always been pretty good at communicating through writing, just because I have written, you know, like anything, when you do it a lot, you get better at it. And I've written tons of articles and tutorials. So I feel like I've always been pretty strong with writing, but yeah, verbally communicating, and just trying to get my ideas across in like a succinct and understandable way. And I think, same with, you know, other people that I've worked with. I think people at other company would agree. Like, I'm sure we've, you know, all had coworkers that, we wish communicated better. We wish, you know, gave better updates on project timelines or whatever it may be. Yeah, that was just, I don't know, my own experience. So I always tell people, like, I feel like if you can communicate well and people can understand what you're saying, and that just shows even in the interview, you know?
Yeah. Like, and how have you learned those skills? I'd be curious.
Have you ever worked full time? So I feel like we're sort of veering here, but I know you obviously you run 1 month, right? And you teach, but have you worked like at a, where you weren't the boss more or less?
Yeah, it's been a while, but yeah, out of college, I was a web developer for 8 years. And so I worked at different agencies where, yeah, just working on teams. And I 100% agree with your, that's why I'm like so curious how you learned.
I was going to say,
but tell me. Yeah.
So I've been working now not full-time at a company almost a year. In August 2019, it'll be a full year. And the biggest difference and the biggest, to me, like just the challenges is the communication and like the human interaction. So now I don't have meetings. I don't have any red tape. I don't have anyone that I'm reporting to. I have to find my own accountability. I am, you know, quote unquote, my own boss, which comes with its own advantages, but also comes with its own challenges. And then working full time, same story. But the challenges and the advantages are like totally different. Instead, right, you're reporting to someone else, depending on the company size, there could be lots of management or there could be, you know, lots of people that are decision makers above you. So just to get one thing moved through can take a lot more time and a lot of back and forth. I think a lot of folks can also just relate to the whole being in meetings. If you work at a bigger company or even like a medium or small company, being in a lot of meetings, you maybe kind of feel like a waste of time, or maybe you shouldn't be there because you're not the best person to be there, or it's taking longer than it is necessary. So like my challenges have totally flipped as far as how I dealt with them at my full-time job. You know, I feel like I still had a lot of work I could have done if I would have stayed there, but I feel like listening and patience, I'm still working on my patience. That's a skill I think I'll forever be honing in on. It's just having patience in moments. Yeah. where, especially for someone who wants to control a lot of things. And I think we all love, I think a lot of us don't like uncertainty, you know, like I just do so well with structure. Uncertainty can sometimes really throw me off. So just learning how to have patience in moments of uncertainty is like the biggest thing. It's something I'm still working on. It's just very different from what it looked like at a full-time job.
Yeah, I hear that. That is such, yeah, it's hard too, especially when you're running a business because you have a lot of responsibility, and oftentimes any one person on your team might not see that, you know, all the other responsibilities. It's kind of like an iceberg, you know, they can only kind of see often part of, you know, what might be going on. And yeah, I think you totally really hit the nail on the head with this idea of communication. And it's also something that's, you know, a lot of ways you have to learn on the job. But it's,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Communication is such an important skill. It's definitely part of that T shape that we were talking about, you know, having those experiences and knowing yourself, knowing how to be patient.
Yeah. So continuing this topic of skills, what tech skills or technologies do you think are particularly important for people to know in 2019? I'm sure you can give like 50 answers, but if you can maybe just try to gear it towards the folks listening to the audience. So people, you know, learning to code, they're a bit later in life, you know, after college, and they're trying to make a career transition into tech.
Yeah. I always say, especially if you're learning to code for the first time, or you've done a little bit of, you know, different things, but you know, you're new or you're looking to upskill at a job, whatever it is, I get the question all the time, you know, what do I start with? Because people feel overwhelmed. I mean, there's a lot of things. The fundamentals where you 100% need to start is HTML and CSS. It sounds basic maybe to some people who have done a little bit of it, or maybe it sounds completely foreign and you don't know what the difference between those two are. Wherever you're at, just getting the fundamentals of that enough so that you can understand how to look under the hood of the web. Every single website on the internet is made with those two languages. You need to know those two languages. It'll explain so much. I think so much will be understood after that. From there, there's really only a third language. There's 1, 2, 3, HTML, CSS. The third language of the web is JavaScript. That's not my opinion. That's like objectively how the web works. There's only three languages on the front end that you can use. And so I say after that, JavaScript is really, it's the behavior of how these languages come together. If you've ever seen something on the website move or open up, you know, different kinds of slideshows or whatever it is, like, it tends to be JavaScript. So these three languages. And then I say, choose one backend language, which these days Python is really kind of exploding, because with Python, you can not only make websites, but you can do things like data analytics. And we teach it. It's a really popular course also at the business school that my co-founder, Matan Griffel, teaches. And so these languages, like that's steps 1, 2, 3, 4, I think are really that foundation of skills. I think it applies to so many different other languages and different situations. And I would say if the last one would be SQL, which is now that's full stack. It's something called full stack when you've done HTML, CSS, JavaScript, a backend language in SQL. So yeah, that tends to be the progression. I know that even that might sound overwhelming to somebody getting started, but just start with the basics, you know, do a little bit every day, whatever it is, buy a book, take a course, or find a friend who knows something, and just a little bit every day. You know, it's amazing what you can learn in a year if you put in a little bit of time every week, you know, so be kind to yourself.
Yes. I feel like it's kind of like exercising or something where I feel like there's some friends that I have who have just undergone these amazing like body transformations. But the thing is, it's never been in like 3 months or 6 months. These are people who have been going to the gym day in, day out, eating healthy. You know, of course they'll have, you know, their off days. They're not doing it 7 days a week. Like they'll go on vacation, everything, but it's now been like 2 years or a year and a half. And you look at those before and after photos they post and it's like, wow. But they're like, you know what? It wasn't easy. I was literally in the gym every single day for an hour a day. This is not an overnight thing. I feel like it's the same thing with learning, right? I'm sure you do too, get lots of people asking, oh, how fast can I get a job? And I think while people do make that like change into a web developer job in 6 months or 9 months, it's such a longer term thing, you know?
Yeah. And I think it comes back to a lot of the things we've been talking about as far as learning, you know, a spoken language, which a lot of people are familiar with. Maybe you have or haven't done it, but you're familiar with the concept of immersion, and that, you know, it really helps if you go to Spain and speak Spanish rather than just using flashcards, right? So it's the same with code and computers and all this stuff that may seem new to some people, digital literacy, all this stuff. It's just doing it a little bit every day. And also, I really recommend, I mean, look, there's probably two different like obvious paths that people are choosing these days. Like one is you do the immersive boot camp, you take off work for, I don't know, 4 months or something, and you do it every day and you make that your life. The reason that those programs are so successful is because they make that path for you and they give you that. It's like the gym membership. You've bought it. A lot of people succeed because you put aside the time and do it. So that works for a lot of people. It's really great. That's there. For people who don't have the option, you know, or the money or the time to do that, this is what we're talking about right now. You know, you kind of have to put that time aside, like that gym time. And really with that other path, the way to do it is, little by little. I tend to say use lots of different resources. There's not one, you know, because I think that's the way I learn new languages, computer languages specifically. If you start reading about something on Medium and then you read a book about it, you watch a video about it, you take a little course on it, and you start seeing the same thing. Oh, we're talking about scope and JavaScript. Oh, this must be important. You know, maybe this comes up a lot. Let me learn about that. You know, that's just kind of one way to like brute force, kind of jump in and just But if you do it a little bit every day, you'll start to see patterns. You'll start to seem more fluent. It's basically the equivalent of going to a planet called JavaScript and trying to speak JavaScript. Just a little bit every day, a lot of different sources. Yeah, put time on the calendar and have some friends that keep you accountable.
Yeah, and I love that metaphor. I've never thought of it before, and I wrote it down because I'm going to use it, I think, more in the future. Mm-hmm. But the idea of the coding bootcamp being like hiring like an expensive trainer at the gym who's like, it's like all the bells and whistles, they're there holding you accountable. You're immersed, as you said. And then the other way is like the self-taught, which could be like, let's think like an at-home workout or something. And I feel like no matter either way, you can achieve results. Like you don't have to go to a gym to, you know, lose weight or whatever. You can do totally at-home workouts, but then it's like, you have to kind of hold yourself more accountable. You're not as immersed, but still a little bit every day can totally pay off and make a huge difference in your life, or, you know, going out on walks or runs outside. So like, you know, free workouts. I love that. I think that's such a good thing. And real quick before we end, I just wanted to talk about 1 month because we've hardly touched on it. Of course, you're the founder there. What's new? What's happening? And for those who don't know, 1 month is a online learn to code and other digital skills platform, and the courses are designed to be like in 30-day increments.
Yeah. We teach people HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and Python. We have other courses, but the ones I mentioned are the core courses that we teach, specifically because these are the skills that I'm seeing in the business school, in New York, you know, where you and I live, and a lot of different industries. These basic skills will get you so far. And so instead of having every single, I mean, you can go to YouTube or Pluralsight. There's a ton of places where you can go, and there's these marketplaces of courses, you know, and you are, as the user, you have to go find what you want. You know, we've really put together, you know, this track that we know works. And so we teach these courses, and yeah, I love it. And I'm excited because we're able to offer support and grading for your homework. And you make real world projects and you have deadlines. Like, it kind of feels like school. It's like that kind of bootcamp feel, but you get to do it in your own time. So yeah, it's really exciting. And we have a lot of free material that we're trying to put out as well. Some free courses and videos and tutorials and stuff like that as well, as much as we can to help people get past that hurdle. Because I guess the thing, and I think you do a really good job at this as well, is getting people past that first hurdle of starting is always the hardest part. And then like that motivation in the first few weeks, which is why we call it 1 month, it's like that first month is the hardest part. And I think your podcast does a really good job of that as well. It's like getting people, like, just hearing stories where people can feel like, oh, I can do that. That person did it. I can maybe do that. You know, I see, you know, so yeah. So that's what I'm excited about. And yeah, it's always good to chat with you about this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show again. And aside from 1 month, where else can people find you online?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter, so @Castig, that's CASTIG. And yeah, 1 month is onemonth.com. So I think if you go there, my face pops up in the corner and you can ask me questions. Something like that.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, of course, Lawrence. Talk to you soon.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Chris. If you missed any of that or would like a recap, the show notes for this episode can be found at learntocodewith.me/podcast. If you're listening to this episode in the future, simply click the search icon in the upper navigation of the website and type in Chris's name. And if you're interested in hearing more from Chris, make sure you also check out our previous conversation back in season 4. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next time.